Usually when we talk about like a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of precision, you know? It
Yeah.
feels very much like engineering.
Right, yeah. It's very mechanical.
Exactly. Like
Right.
you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, the doctor points right to it, and the intervention is just super obvious.
So the bone, cast it, and you're done.
Yeah. It's a completely mechanistic view of a system.
Which makes sense because, I mean, we appreciate things that can be isolated, right?
Yeah.
Things that can be quantified and categorized into a binary state.
Broken or unbroken.
Right, pathological or healthy. There's no in between in that kind of model.
But so step into the world of global ecological forecasting, and suddenly that X-ray machine is just fundamentally flawed.
It really is. It's a completely different ballgame.
We are looking at a diagnostic landscape that's built entirely around measuring the pathology. Like it tracks the disease with terrifying accuracy,
But it has absolutely no mathematical way to visualize the cure.
which is just wild to think about. And if you extend that medical analogy, it's akin to a trauma ward that only ever monitors a pathogen's replication rate.
Right. If you only track the virus, you systematically ignore the fact that the patient actually possesses a complex immune system.
Yeah, you optimize all your interventions around destroying the invader.
Exactly. Rather than strengthening the host.
And that is the exact paradigm shift we are unpacking for you today. Welcome to the deep dive, by the way.
It's a massive shift we're talking about today.
It really is. So we are looking at this incredibly comprehensive 2023 paper from the journal Global Environmental Change.
Yeah, it's titled Towards a Better Future for Biodiversity and People, Modeling Nature Futures.
Right, authored by a massive global coalition of experts led by Hyejin Kim and Henrique M. Pereira.
And they are trying to answer a question that on the surface sounds simple, but it actually completely breaks our current computational models.
Okay, let's unpack this. What's the question?
The question is basically, how do we actually plan for a future where both nature and humanity thrive, rather than just, mathematically plotting the trajectory of our mutual destruction?
Which sounds like something we should have figured out by now, right? I mean, instead of just doomsday forecasting, we want to co-create positive futures.
Exactly. But it's not just wishful thinking. The framework they propose, the Nature Futures Framework or NFF, it's rigorous.
Right, it's mathematical.
Highly mathematical, and it's policy driven. It's designed to fix a massive blind spot in our current global climate models.
But before we can understand the solution, I think we really have to look at why the current gold standard models are actually failing us.
Yeah, we have to start with the baseline, which is pretty gloomy.
Really gloomy. So the paper points out this terrifying finding from the IPBES.
Right, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services.
A very long name, but they're basically the biodiversity equivalent of the IPCC for climate change, right?
Yeah, that's a perfect way to describe them, yeah. They evaluated the absolute gold standard forecasting models used by the broader climate community.
To see what happens to global biodiversity in the coming decades. And we're talking about the models that use the SSPs and RCPs.
Right, the shared socioeconomic pathways and the representative concentration pathways.
I know anyone who follows global policy is probably familiar with these acronyms, but the way they interact is what's critical here, isn't
It is. So, just as a quick refresher, the
it?
SSPs basically give us the demographic and economics narratives.
Like, does the world cooperate or do we, fracture into nationalist rivalries?
Exactly. And then the RCPs are the physical atmospheric math,
Yeah.
the actual greenhouse gas trajectories that result from those human choices.
Okay, so when the IPBES ran the numbers, they looked at the absolute best case scenario currently available in the scientific literature, right?
The absolute best. They combine SSP1, which is this narrative of sustainable green growth, massive reduction in global inequality, a huge shift away from fossil fuels.
The utopian scenario.
Right. And they combine that with RCP 2.6, which is the most aggressive emissions reduction pathway we have.
The one aiming to keep global warming well below 2 degrees Celsius.
Yes. So the greenest of the green scenarios.
Like, if we hit all our Paris Agreement targets, if we magically redesign our energy grids overnight, solve global wealth disparity, all of it.
Exactly. And the terrifying finding from the assessment is that even in this absolute best case mathematical combination, we still fail.
We fail to halt global biodiversity
We
loss.
completely fail. Regulating ecosystem services just continue to degrade heavily, and the socioeconomic fallout hits the poorest nations the hardest.
That is just, it's staggering. So the models predict that even if we do everything perfectly regarding carbon and climate, the underlying ecological web still collapses.
Yeah.
Why? Like, what is the flaw in the methodology of these models that allows them to solve climate change but completely fail the biosphere?
Well, the mechanistic flaw is that these models are hyper-optimized for climate mitigation.
Okay, meaning what exactly?
Meaning they are essentially massive, complex calculators of negative anthropogenic drivers.
Oh, wow. So they only calculate our negative footprint.
Exactly. How much land we clear, how much carbon we emit, how much nitrogen runoff we generate. They only measure how much damage humans inflict on the system.
Which brings us back to that X-ray analogy from earlier.
Right, exactly.
The current climate models are intensely tracking the planetary fever, which is the carbon concentration.
Right. And the doctors are screaming, you know, we have to lower the fever to 1.5 degrees.
So they lower the fever, but the patient's vital organs, like the soil microbiomes, the ocean currents, the pollinator networks, they're still failing.
Because the model never actually simulated how to heal them. It assumed humans only exert downward pressure on ecological health.
So when you run a scenario like SSP1, the model's version of a solution is just, well, minimizing that downward pressure.
Yeah, it models us doing less damage.
Yeah.
But reducing harm is mathematically very different from creating a positive feedback loop of restoration.
That makes total sense. Like, if a forest is already degraded, simply stopping the logging doesn't automatically model the complex biological recovery of that forest.
Exactly. The models literally lack the algorithms to simulate humans as positive drivers of ecological health.
And the psychological fallout of this modeling failure has to be profound, right?
Oh, it's huge. The authors of the paper point out that because these multi-billion-dollar global supercomputers only output scenarios of varied destruction, they just fail to engage human imagination.
Right, for societal transformation. If the only highly credentialed options presented to you are apocalypse or slightly delayed apocalypse, it inevitably breeds apathy.
Of course it does. If the math says the coral reefs die, even if we all recycle and transition to solar, human motivation just collapses.
So the paper makes the argument that optimism and empathy aren't just, fluffy emotional states.
No, they are necessary catalysts for collective action. People need empirical proof that their actions can actually initiate a positive trajectory.
Not just a less bad impact.
Right. And to provide that proof, Kim, Pereira, and their colleagues argue, we basically need to overhaul the underlying architecture of how we model the world.
Which leads us directly into their proposed solution, the Nature Futures Framework.
Right, but NFF.
So the goal here is to build a model that actually tracks the good. But to do that, they first had to figure out how to quantify what good actually means to a global population of 8 billion people.
And that is not easy. You can't just have a single variable for ecological health.
Right, because human beings possess incredibly diverse, culturally specific relationships with the natural world.
Exactly. So the NFF conceptualizes this complexity as a triangle. It represents three primary value perspectives on nature.
Okay, let's break down the geometry of this triangle. What is the first corner?
The first corner is nature for nature, or NN.
Okay.
This framework values nature for its intrinsic existence, entirely independent of human utility.
Ah, so the classic preservationist viewpoint, I think of like E.O. Wilson's half-earth concept, you know.
Yeah, the idea of dedicating massive swaths of the planet entirely to autonomous wilderness. The strategy here is typically referred to as land sparing.
Land sparing. So you draw a hard boundary. Humans live and produce intensely on one side of the line, and nature just does its thing on the other side.
Right. Natural processes like evolution, migration, predator-prey dynamics, they occur without our interference.
So you value the existence of a deep sea hydrothermal vent ecosystem simply because it has an inherent right to exist.
Exactly. Not because you plan to harvest anything from it.
Got it. Okay, so what about the second corner? I assume this shifts the focus back to human utility.
Yes. The second corner is nature for society, or NS. This perspective is built entirely on instrumental values.
So viewing the environment through the lens of what it provides to human civilization.
Right. This is the realm of ecosystem services, which really became highly dominant in the late 90s.
Oh, right. Like Robert Costanza's famous 1997 paper, the one that tried to put a literal dollar amount on the services the world's ecosystems provide to the global economy.
That is a perfect example. In the NS corner, nature is viewed as highly functioning natural capital.
So we're talking about sustainable agriculture, bioeconomies, water filtration, climate regulation.
Yes, and maximizing sustainable yields.
Right.
The goal isn't to leave the forest untouched, like an NN.
Right.
The goal is to manage the forest so efficiently that it can provide timber, capture carbon, and prevent landslides for human settlements in perpetuity.
Okay, so we have intrinsic value in corner one, instrumental value in corner two. What defines the third corner of the NFF?
The third corner addresses a massive historical blind spot in Western ecological modeling. It is nature as culture, or NC.
Nature as culture.
Yes. This focuses on relational values. It basically rejects the dichotomy that humans and nature are separate entities interacting with each other.
Wow. Okay. So it views people and nature as an indivisible co-evolved whole.
Exactly.
But how does a computational model define an indivisible whole? Like, what does that actually look like on the ground?
Well, it looks like cultural landscapes that have been actively shaped by human habitation for millennia. Think of the concept of Pachamama in Andean cultures.
Or like indigenous fire management practices in Australia.
Yes. Perfect example. Preserving a specific landscape in this corner isn't just about protecting biodiversity, which would be nature for nature.
And it's not about ensuring a sustainable harvest, which is nature for society.
Right. It is about preserving the spiritual heritage, the linguistic ties, and the intergenerational identity of the community that is woven into that specific geography.
The landscape and the culture are essentially the same organism.
Precisely.
Okay, so we have our triangle. Nature for nature, nature for society, nature is culture. But the paper emphasizes that these aren't just like arbitrary philosophical buckets.
No, they are mathematically derived. The authors describe these three perspectives as emerging from a principal component analysis of a hyperdimensional space of human preferences.
Okay, wait. I want to pause on the phrase principal component analysis of a hyperdimensional space because it sounds like we're modeling quantum mechanics or something.
I know, it sounds incredibly dense.
For the listeners trying to visualize this, a principal component analysis, or a PCA, is a dimensionality reduction technique, right?
That's the exact statistical term, yeah.
Yeah.
So imagine you conduct a global survey with 1,000 different questions about how people value a river.
Okay.
Some care about the fish, some about the hydroelectric potential, some about ancestral burial sites along the banks.
Right. Everyone has a different priority.
If you map the answers of millions of people, you get a massive swirling cloud of data points in a hyperdimensional space.
Yeah.
Literally 1,000 different axes of preference.
Which is obviously impossible for any policymaker to actually use.
Right, it's just too much noise. So a PCA looks at that giant cloud and finds the directions where the data varies the most.
It finds the main trends.
It calculates the eigenvectors, the underlying trends that explain the majority of the variance in human opinion.
Okay, I follow.
And the authors are arguing that if you run a PCA on the infinite ways humans value the Earth, the data naturally clusters along these three primary vectors.
The three corners of our triangle.
Yes. They are fundamental complementary dimensions of how our species interacts with the biosphere.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting because I understand the statistical clustering, but I have a major philosophical pushback here.
Let's hear it.
Looking at the triangle, my immediate reaction is that these three eigenvectors are fundamentally in conflict.
Okay, how so?
Well, if I am a policymaker, I can't optimize for all three. If I designate a massive old-growth forest as a strict, no-touch wilderness to satisfy nature for nature,
right.
I legally cannot allow a logging company to extract sustainable timber for nature for society. It feels like a zero-sum game. Don't these values conflict? You can't have your tree and log it too.
That is the standard pushback. And that zero-sum assumption is the foundational premise of our current economic models, which is exactly why we're stuck.
Okay, tell me why I'm wrong.
You are describing a Pareto frontier where improving one metric strictly requires degrading another. But the Nature Futures framework posits that for the vast majority of our global systems, these values are intricately connected.
Intricately connected how?
They are capable of powerful synergistic reinforcement. They are not mutually exclusive.
I'm going to need a highly specific mechanical example of that because the physics of logging a tree versus leaving it standing still seems mutually exclusive to me.
Okay, fair enough. Let's look at the mechanics of a keystone species. Consider the reintroduction of apex predators, like wolves in Yellowstone.
Classic example.
From a pure nature for nature perspective, you protect the wolf simply to restore the intrinsic ecological integrity of the wild, right?
Right, which usually triggers massive pushback from the nature for society camp, specifically ranchers and farmers who view the predator as a direct threat to their economic capital.
Initially, yes, absolutely. But look at the long-term nonlinear dynamics. Wolves exert profound regulatory pressure on herbivore populations, like
Oh.
elk and deer. In the absence of predators, deer populations explode. And their overgrazing devastates local flora, which severely degrades soil retention.
Which eventually impacts human agricultural yields on the periphery of the wildlands.
Exactly. So by protecting the wolf for its own sake, which is NN, you mathematically reduce herbivore damage to human crops.
Wow, okay.
And simultaneously, you improve downstream water quality because the riverbanks are no longer being overgrazed. You create a massive compounding benefit to nature for society.
So the action taken at the extreme edge of one corner actually initiates a positive ripple effect that elevates the baseline of the other corners.
Yes. And that ripple effect isn't just ecological. If we bring in the nature as culture aspect, let's look at traditional shade-grown coffee systems in Latin America.
Okay, I love coffee.
The community manages the forest canopy to grow coffee, which is a deep cultural heritage and a relational practice, so that's NC.
Right.
By maintaining that complex canopy rather than clear-cutting for monoculture, they provide critical overwintering habitat for migratory songbirds.
Which is nature for nature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And those birds, in turn, provide free pest control for the coffee crops, maximizing the economic yield for the farmers, which is nature for society.
Oh, wow. The values completely overlap and reinforce each
They
other.
really do.
That reframes the challenge entirely. But so if the values can be synergistic, how do we actually visualize progress? How does a multi-billion dollar supercomputer plot the trajectory of a shade-grown coffee farm versus a monoculture plantation?
This is where the paper introduces a spatial geometry. They define this multidimensional state space.
Let's map this out for everyone.
Okay, visualize a three-dimensional graph. The X, Y, and Z axes correspond to our three values: nature for nature, nature for society, and nature as culture.
Got it.
Every single system on Earth, a local wetland, a national grid, or the whole global biosphere, currently occupies a specific coordinate point in that 3D space based on its current health across those three metrics.
So, like a pristine, highly protected ice shelf in Antarctica scores incredibly high on the nature for nature axis, but
Right.
it essentially sits at zero for society and culture. Exactly. Whereas a highly industrialized, intensive corn farm in Iowa might score decently on nature for society because it yields high calories, but it sits near zero for intrinsic biodiversity and cultural relational values.
That's exactly right. That's the current state. The goal of the Nature Futures framework is to identify pathways that move a system from its current, often degraded coordinate outward toward a desirable endpoint.
And they call this endpoint the Nature Futures Frontier.
Yes, the frontier.
Wow.
Mathematically, this frontier is represented as a convex surface expanding into the positive space of the graph.
Okay, so to reach this frontier, the system must undergo improvements relative to its present state across all three value axes simultaneously.
Yes, all three at once.
You're saying the system has to move up and to the right on every single axis at the same time. That feels like, I don't know, a thermodynamic
It
impossibility.
sounds impossible, yeah.
Let's adapt an analogy to simplify this complex geometry. It's like a municipal budget, right? If a city wants to increase its infrastructure spending, it either has to cut social services or raise taxes.
Because the capital is finite.
Right. You're suggesting a scenario where the city somehow finds a way to increase infrastructure, increase social services, and lower taxes all at the same time, just through sheer efficiency.
That budget analogy is actually really instructive, but it assumes a stagnant economy. What if the city invests in a new, highly efficient public transit system that drastically reduces traffic congestion?
Okay.
The reduction in traffic cuts road maintenance costs and lowers public health expenditures related to air pollution. The city suddenly has new compounding sources of value that weren't in the original zero-sum ledger.
Ah, so the efficiency literally creates new capital.
Exactly. The paper argues that absolute zero-sum trade-offs do exist, but primarily at the extreme boundaries of the frontier.
What do you mean by extreme boundaries?
Well, if a commercial pine plantation is already 99% mathematically optimized for maximum sustainable timber yield, trying to squeeze out that final 1% of efficiency might require toxic chemical interventions.
Which would irreversibly destroy the remaining biodiversity.
Right. But we don't live on the extreme boundary. The vast majority of our global ecosystems occupy highly inefficient degraded space well inside the curve.
So, from where we currently sit, synergistic increases across all three axes aren't just possible, they are actually the most logical pathway forward.
Yes.
So, let's map a specific large-scale policy intervention onto this 3D state space. How do specific actions map here? The source gives the example of protected areas.
It does. It explicitly analyzes the designation of protected areas, which is the cornerstone of the UN's goal to protect 30% of the planet by 2030. But a protected area is not a monolith.
Right. They come in vastly different legal frameworks.
Exactly. If a government gazettes a strict no-take marine reserve, where no human activity is allowed, that policy maps aggressively along the nature for nature axis.
But if they establish a biosphere reserve that includes a large buffer zone specifically designed for local, sustainable, artisanal fishing,
then that policy pushes the system outward along the nature for society axis.
And if they designate a territory as an indigenous protected and conserved area, an IPCA, where traditional ecological knowledge dictates the land management,
that intervention drives the system along the nature as culture axis.
Crucially, though, based on what we just talked about, all of these have positive bleed-over effects, right? They don't stay confined to their respective axes.
That is the crux of the entire framework.
Yeah.
They generate massive spatial spillover effects.
Like what?
Well, take the strict no-take marine reserve, the NN intervention. It functions as an undisturbed nursery for pelagic fish.
Okay.
As the population density inside the reserve hits its carrying capacity, the fish naturally spill over the boundary into adjacent waters.
Oh, dramatically boosting the catch for the local fishing economy.
Exactly, which is NS. The initial intervention was pure intrinsic conservation, but the systemic outcome was instrumental economic growth.
And conversely, legally empowering an indigenous community to manage their ancestral landscape, which is NC, often results in biodiversity indices that meet or exceed those of strict state-run national parks.
Because traditional harvesting techniques are co-evolved with the local ecology, they support NN.
Now, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the paper makes a critical point about scale, right? We are not trying to force every single square kilometer of the Earth to sit perfectly in the center of the triangle.
Right, absolutely not. At a micro scale, a specific bay might be optimized purely for sustainable aquaculture, so high NS, while an adjacent bay is left entirely untouched, high NN.
So a specific forest might lean heavily toward one perspective, and local asymmetry is perfectly acceptable.
It's necessary. But at the regional scale, and absolutely at the macro planetary scale, all three value systems must coexist and counterbalance each other.
They have to reflect the true diversity of global human-nature relationships.
Yes. The global aggregate of these points must populate the entire convex surface of the nature futures frontier.
So the theory is beautiful, the geometry makes perfect sense. But to actually reach this frontier, the models have to calculate how these systems interact.
And this is where current science has a massive blind spot.
Right. We have to actually feed data into a supercomputer. We have to mathematically model the wolf, the coffee farmer, and the spillover fish simultaneously.
Which brings us to social ecological feedbacks.
The missing link.
Yes. Understanding nonlinear dynamics, where cause and effect loop back on themselves, is central to moving toward a positive future. But existing models barely capture them.
A social ecological feedback occurs when, like, a change in the physical environment triggers a behavioral shift in human society, right, which then triggers a subsequent change in the physical environment, right?
Exactly. And the authors methodically expose the feedback gaps across all three corners of our triangle.
Okay, let's start with nature for nature. What's the feedback gap there?
Well, we have highly sophisticated computational models for pure ecology. We can model the atmospheric carbon cycle, run complex hydrology simulations, predict wildfire contagion patterns.
But they miss something.
They consistently fail to model how autonomous animal behaviors act as structural engineers for ecosystems that eventually feed back into human economic models.
Give me the specific example from the research.
Beavers.
Beavers, the ultimate ecosystem engineers.
They really are. Beavers alter landscapes on a geological scale. They fell specific timber, they block water to construct dams, they drastically alter hydrological flow.
And in doing so, they spontaneously generate expansive wetland ecosystems. They create complex habitats out of linear streams.
And these newly engineered wetlands provide immense, highly quantifiable services. They filter agricultural runoff, they attenuate floodwaters during extreme weather events, and act as drought-resistant carbon sinks.
So they're essentially executing millions of dollars worth of municipal water infrastructure work for free.
Precisely. But how does a current supercomputer view the beaver?
I'm guessing it doesn't.
It generally doesn't. Our massive environmental models completely failed to compute the nonlinear feedback loop, where beaver activity translates into human well-being and municipal savings.
Because the model cannot calculate the systemic value of the beaver.
Right. So a local policymaker relying on that model might only see the immediate localized cost, like a beaver dam flooding a single rural road.
And then the model outputs a recommendation to just cull the beaver.
Entirely missing the cascading systemic collapse that follows.
It is just mind-blowing that our multi-billion-dollar global supercomputers trying to save the planet literally don't know how to compute a beaver building a dam.
It is. And the complexity compounds when we confront the nature as culture feedback gap. This is the least understood, least quantified, and least modeled area of global ecology.
I imagine that's because it is intensely difficult to assign a numerical value to a cultural paradigm.
Right. It requires translating relational epistemology into actionable data. The paper highlights a really profound example. The Western Red Cedar in the coastal temperate rainforests of British Columbia.
Okay, the cedar tree.
For the indigenous First Nations of the Pacific Northwest, the cedar is not viewed merely as a commodity for timber extraction. It is classified as a cultural keystone species.
Right. A cultural keystone species. So it operates on the human relational network the same way an ecological keystone, like the wolf, operates on a food web.
The structural parallel is exact. The cedar connects an intricate web of feedbacks that link physical harvesting practices to deep spiritual traditions, language preservation, and long-term community livelihoods.
So the physiological health of the cedar forest is inextricably linked to the social cohesion of the human population living within it.
Exactly.
But I mean, I have to point out how wild this sounds for data scientists. How can you possibly expect an algorithmic climate model to ingest the spiritual connection to a tree?
It's a huge challenge.
If you try to force a qualitative, deeply sacred relational value into a binary quantitative matrix, don't you inherently strip it of its meaning?
That is the epistemological friction at the heart of this paper. But the authors argue that ignoring it is a worse scientific failure. Zero current models incorporate this.
Right. If the model assigns a value of zero to the cultural keystone, the forest is inevitably modeled solely for its instrumental timber yield, which is NS.
Or its carbon sequestration, NN. The cultural feedback loop is just erased from the future scenario entirely.
Which brings us to the final gap, nature for society feedbacks. I would assume this is the one area our current economic models actually understand. I mean, we track supply and demand constantly.
We do track the linear negative drivers excellently. Mm-hmm. An integrated assessment model is very adept at calculating how crop demand drives global land use change.
Like predicting exactly how many hectares of the Amazon will be clear-cut to plant soy for cattle feed.
Yes. It models humans as a relentless consumption algorithm. But it fails to model the positive, nonlinear feedbacks of optimization.
What do you mean by optimization feedbacks?
Current models struggle to simulate how optimizing a landscape for multiple overlapping values, like transitioning a region to complex agroforestry or indigenous land management, dramatically improves the holistic quality of life for that community.
And why does that specific improvement in quality of life matter to the algorithmic forecast?
Because a secure, healthy population fundamentally changes its behavior.
Oh, interesting.
If an agroforestry model stabilizes a community's microeconomy, purifies their local watershed, and improves their physical health, they are no longer operating from a state of resource desperation.
So they are significantly less likely to engage in the destructive clear-cutting of the adjacent primary forest.
Exactly. Their elevated quality of life acts as a positive feedback mechanism that alters future societal decisions about land use.
But our current models don't possess the architecture to simulate this virtuous cycle. They just treat humans as static variables of destruction.
Yes, rather than dynamic learning entities capable of adaptive management.
Why are these feedbacks so incredibly hard to model? Is it just the disciplinary silos in academia?
That's a huge part of it. Because to accurately model these feedbacks, it requires coupling ecological science with human sociology, psychology, and economics across different scales, local to global.
It requires radical integration.
Yes. And the authors highlight the core belief that knowledge requires diverse perspectives. This integration is the prerequisite for transformative global policy.
So explain why incorporating these feedbacks could actually change policy in the real world.
Think about the impact. If a highly robust, universally accepted computational model can mathematically prove that securing land rights for indigenous peoples preserves cultural heritage, which is NC,
right,
and protects biodiversity, NN, and ensures sustainable livelihoods, NS, You have just turned a moral argument into hard, actionable data.
You give policymakers the empirical leverage they need to justify massive systemic change.
Exactly.
But to feed that data into models, we have to find a way to measure the unmeasurable. We need hard data inputs. We need indicators.
Yes, we do.
How do Kim and Pereira propose we extract a quantifiable indicator from a spiritual or intrinsic value without destroying its essence?
Well, this is where the framework transitions from theory to applied methodology. The authors insist that to make the NFF work, we need indicators co-developed with local stakeholders.
Co-developed. So a data scientist sitting in a laboratory in Geneva cannot unilaterally define the parameters of ecological success for a coastal fishing community in Southeast Asia.
Precisely. The variables have to be defined by the people living inside the feedback loop.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
The paper structures this by breaking interventions into actionable categories. They separate indirect drivers from direct drivers.
Let's define the difference in this context. What's an indirect driver?
Indirect drivers are the underlying societal structures, governance systems, institutional frameworks, economic policies, anthropogenic assets.
And direct drivers.
Those are the physical, tangible interventions in the natural environment, like building a dam, altering a fishing quota, or planting a forest.
Okay, let's look at some specific examples of these indicators from the research. Table 1 in the source material provides a really fascinating glimpse into this.
It does. They start by identifying cross-cutting indicators. These are metrics that fundamentally alter the trajectory of all three corners of the Nature Futures Triangle simultaneously.
Okay, what's an example of a cross-cutting indicator?
A prime example, they suggest, is tracking the percentage of countries assigning legal rights to nature in their constitutions.
Oh, wow. Like a massive paradigm shift in jurisprudence. We're talking about legal frameworks like Ecuador's constitution recognizing the rights of Pachamama, or New Zealand granting legal personhood to a river.
Exactly. Tracking that metric isn't just a legal curiosity. It is a profound indicator of an indirect driver, governance, that structurally alters how society interacts with all three values.
Okay, what about the specific indicators for the individual corners? How do we measure pure nature for nature?
For the NN goal, the indicators lean heavily into classical ecological metrics. A core indicator is the absolute number of species prevented from extinction.
Or measuring the structural intactness of primary ecosystems. It is a straightforward quantification of intrinsic preservation.
Right.
And nature for society. How is that explicitly measured as a variable?
They focus on the distribution and reliable flow of ecosystem services. For example, an indicator might quantify the exact percentage of a regional population whose agricultural yield is directly dependent on wild pollination networks.
Or measuring the access to clean water regulated by intact upstream watersheds. It's about measuring the secure delivery of natural capital.
Exactly.
Which brings us back to the most difficult corner, nature as culture. How do you construct a mathematically viable indicator for cultural relational values?
They rely on highly specific proxy variables. The paper references measuring the legal and practical possibility for a community to perform traditional occupations like pastoralism or artisanal hunting without state restriction.
Oh, as a proxy for social cohesion. That is a brilliant proxy. You aren't forcing the model to calculate the spiritual weight of a ritual. You are just having the model track a Boolean variable. Does the community have the sovereign freedom to practice their ancestral livelihood?
Right. If yes, the nature as culture metric is healthy. The freedom to engage in the relational practice is the indicator of the system's integrity.
But how does this framework address the ultimate overarching goal of any socioeconomic model? Human happiness. Quality of life is notoriously measured differently across the three axes.
It is. The framework acknowledges that quality of life is not a monolith.
Let's bring the listener into the conversation here. Imagine you are taking a global survey about your quality of life. The survey asks, are you happier knowing a tiger exists out there in the wild, even if you never see it?
Right. That's NS.
Or are you happier knowing your municipal water is clean and cheap? That's NS. Or are you happier knowing you can pass your grandfather's farming traditions to your kids? That's NC.
The NFF maps exactly those divergent psychological profiles.
Mm-hmm.
Under NN, quality of life is weighted by the enjoyment of experiencing nature and knowing other species are protected.
The deeply held psychological piece of knowing evolutionary processes are safe.
Yes. Under NS, it's measured by the satisfaction from quality goods and services from nature and their equitable sharing.
And under NC, it's measured by preserving nature-based cultural heritage and intergenerational social cohesion.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is that forcing a computational model to ingest these diverse, overlapping indicators ensures that future policies won't just ruthlessly optimize for a single variable.
Like maximum timber yield.
Right. It forces the algorithm to identify a completely different operational pathway. It optimizes for a truly holistic view of human happiness and ecological health.
So we have the theoretical geometry of the framework, we have the complex feedbacks, and we have the specific indicators to feed the data arrays. The ultimate question is implementation. How do policymakers actually use this toolkit in the real world?
The paper outlines three specific ways to model these scenarios for policy: policy review, policy screening, and policy design.
Let's break these down chronologically, starting with policy review.
Policy review is an ex post analysis. It is looking backward in time to evaluate implemented policies.
So, like, we established a marine protected area 10 years ago. Did it actually achieve anything?
Exactly. And to answer that, scientists deploy sophisticated statistical techniques like statistical matching and counterfactual analysis.
Comparing what happened to what would have happened without the policy.
Right. You examine the geography where the policy was implemented, and you construct a statistically identical synthetic area that mimics all the baseline characteristics, but you mathematically withhold the policy intervention.
You simulate an alternate timeline where the law was never passed.
And by comparing the real-world data against the counterfactual simulation, you isolate the precise systemic impact of the policy across all three NFF values.
That's policy review, looking backward. What is the second application?
Policy screening. This is ex ante, but focused purely on the short term, looking forward a decade or so.
So predicting the immediate consequences of altering direct drivers, like changing fishing regulations or placing a new marine protected area.
Right. In this application, you do not need to model massive demographic shifts. You are narrowly modeling the immediate ecological and social impacts.
If we ban the use of gill nets in this specific estuary, what happens to the fish stock and what is the exact economic impact on the local fishing fleet over the next couple years?
Exactly. It's a rapid assessment tool for immediate trade-offs. Which leads to the third application, policy design or agenda setting.
This is the macro level, long-term ex-ante modeling.
Yes, this is where you look out to 2050 and beyond. And this is where you absolutely must model the indirect drivers like GDP, demographic change, and those highly complex social ecological feedbacks we discussed earlier.
You are trying to identify the broader societal transformations necessary to move the global system onto the convex nature futures frontier.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? Let's walk the listener through a concrete, realistic scenario to demonstrate how these three applications interact.
Let's do it.
Imagine a coastal town. The local government is deciding whether to implement a total permanent ban on bottom trawling in their bay. It's a highly destructive fishing method, but it's the backbone of the local economy. How do they use review, screening, and design to make the ultimate decision?
It's a perfect test case. Step one, they deploy policy review. They look at historical data and construct counterfactual models of other similar towns that implemented a ban a decade ago.
They use NFF indicators to assess the historical outcomes. Did the biodiversity actually recover, which is NN? Did the total economic value of the fishery stabilize, NS? Did the community maintain its maritime culture,
NT? Yeah, they gather the empirical historical evidence. Then step two, they use policy screening to look at their own specific bay. They run a short-term predictive model.
And the simulation probably reveals a harsh immediate reality, right?
Oh, absolutely. In the first few years of the ban, the nature for society metric dips precipitously as fleets are grounded and jobs are lost. Simultaneously, the nature for nature metric spikes as the destruction ceases.
The model clearly eliminates the painful short-term trade-off.
But then, step three, they deploy long-term policy design. They feed the nonlinear feedbacks into the model, extending to 2050. The model calculates that as the habitat radically recovers, it triggers a population explosion in high-value fish.
Which allows a new, highly profitable, sustainable line fishery to emerge. And maybe the pristine marine environment catalyzes a lucrative ecotourism sector.
Exactly. The long-term simulation shows the system escaping the zero-sum trap. By 2045, the model projects the town moving firmly into the convex nature futures frontier.
The marine biodiversity is higher, the economy is stronger, and the cultural connection to a healthy bay is deeply reinforced. That sequence demonstrates the true power of adaptive decision-making.
It really does. It emphasizes that models aren't crystal balls, they are tools. They allow society to test drive a policy in a simulation that respects diverse human values before committing resources in the real world.
It provides the roadmap to navigate through the messy short-term trade-offs to reach the synergistic frontier. This sounds like a utopian solution.
It sounds great, but
But the paper is very clear-eyed about the massive hurdles still standing in the way of making this a global reality, isn't it?
very clear-eyed. The roadblocks are monumental. The first and most critical hurdle is data gaps. There's a severe lack of time series monitoring data.
Those models currently use space for time replacement to calibrate, which isn't ideal. Can you explain that?
Sure. Let's say you want to predict how a force will respond to 50 years of warming, but you only have data for the last 3 years. You can't look backward in time. So you substitute geographic space.
You find a forest 500 miles south that is currently experiencing the temperature your target forest will reach in 50 years.
Exactly. You assume the southern forest is a perfect proxy for the future state of the northern forest. It's a clever workaround, but it ignores highly specific local complexities.
To build rigorous models for the NFF, we desperately need vast sensor networks to generate real-time series data. What is the second major roadblock?
The IPCC legacy. The dominant RCP and SSP models are heavily, almost exclusively, tailored to climate change and carbon mitigation.
The entire global scientific apparatus is built around them.
Right. Adapting these calcified legacy systems to the fluid, multidimensional metrics of the Nature Futures framework is going to be incredibly challenging.
Which leads to the third requirement, the need for big data. To make this work, we need high-resolution remote sensing, machine learning, and cloud-based computing to forecast biodiversity responses.
We need unprecedented integration of frontier technologies to process the sheer volume of data.
I have to ask, though, if we are relying on AI, machine learning, and big data to tell us how to value the spiritual connection to a Western red cedar, aren't we risking losing the human element the framework is trying to save?
This raises an important question, and it's one the authors confront directly under the concept of uncertainty in models, specifically epistemological and ontological uncertainties.
We are merging different disciplines and cultures. There will be friction and unknowns. How do they propose we prevent the AI from colonizing the cultural data?
By pointing out the paper's emphasis on participatory approaches, the models don't dictate the values. The machine doesn't assign the worth. The stakeholders dictate the values.
The community tells the model, "This forest is sacred." The machine doesn't judge that against a market standard, it just calculates the ripple effects of preserving it.
Exactly. The human sets the destination. The machine just processes the fluid dynamics to help us get there, which means the ultimate challenge isn't technological.
The ultimate challenge is shifting the entire scientific community from modeling negative anthropogenic drivers, how humans destroy, to positive drivers.
Yes. We have to prove that humans and biodiversity can positively contribute to each other.
Well, this has been an incredibly deep dive. Let's briefly recap the journey. We've seen how current models predict a bleak future because they only measure our negative impacts.
Right. They track the fever, but not the immune system.
The Nature Futures framework offers a new paradigm, mapping a state space where nature for nature, nature for society, and nature as culture all push us toward a positive frontier.
We just need the data, the indicators, and the willingness to model the beautiful, complex feedbacks between beavers, trees, and human happiness.
And whether you, the listener, are managing a business, voting on local policies, or just interacting with your local park, you inherently hold these three value perspectives.
You do. You care about the wild, you need resources, and you derive identity from the landscape.
Recognizing these overlapping values is the first step to making better, more holistic decisions in your own life. And I want to leave you with a final provocative thought.
What is it?
The paper reveals that our current predictive models essentially treat human beings as a global disease, only calculating how to minimize our symptoms.
Like an invasive species.
But what if the simple act of reprogramming our global models to mathematically treat humans as a positive keystone species capable of co-creating ecosystems is the exact psychological shift required to make that utopian future a reality?
That's a profound question. Does the model reflect the world, or does the world ultimately become the model?
Leave that to ponder. Thanks for diving deep with us.